Chapter 41. Has anyone seen my mother? The road to Savatthi was now familiar to Sariputta. Because he and Anathapindika had nourished people's interest in the Buddha and the Sangha, they were greeted warmly wherever they went. At nights, the bhikkhus rested in the cool forests along the banks of the Achiravati River. They traveled in three groups. The Buddha and Sariputta led the first group. The second group was headed by Asaji. The third group was under the guidance of Moggallana. The bhikkhus maintained peaceful serenity as they walked. Sometimes local people gathered in the forests or along the riverbanks to listen to the Buddha's teaching. The day they arrived in Savatthi, they were greeted by Sudatta and Prince Jetta, who took them to the new monastery. Seeing how well-planned Jetavana was, the Buddha praised Sudatta. Sudatta responded by saying it was all thanks to the ideas and labor of Venerable Sariputta and Prince Jetta. Novice Rahula was now 12 years old. Though he had been assigned to study under Sariputta's guidance, Sariputta had been gone for 6 months, and so Moggallana had taken his place. At Jetavana, Rahula could resume his studies with Sariputta. Prince Jetta and Sudatta arranged a reception immediately after the Buddha's arrival. Prince Jetta had come to deeply admire the Buddha through his contacts with Venerable Sariputta. They invited all the local people to come to hear the Buddha speak on the Dharma. Many came, including Prince Jetta's mother, Queen Malika, and his 16-year-old sister, Princess Vajiri. After hearing about the Buddha for months, everyone was most anxious to see him in person. The Buddha spoke about the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. After hearing the Dharma talk, the queen and princess felt their hearts open. They both wanted to become lay disciples, but did not dare to ask. The queen wanted to first seek the approval of her husband, King Basanadi. She was sure that in the near future the king would meet the Buddha and share her feelings. Basanadi's own sister, who was King Bimbisara's wife, had already taken the three refuges with the Buddha 3 years before. Many important religious leaders in Savatthi also attended the Buddha's discourse that day. Most came out of curiosity rather than a desire to learn anything. But several of them felt their hearts suddenly illuminated when they heard the Buddha speak. Others saw in him a worthy opponent who challenged their own beliefs. Everyone agreed that his presence in Savatthi was a significant event in the spiritual life of Kosala. When the reception and Dharma talk were over, Sudatta respectfully knelt before the Buddha and said, "My family and I, together with all our friends and relations, offer Jetavana Monastery to you and your Sangha." The Buddha said, "Sudatta, your merit is great. Thanks to you, the Sangha will be protected from sun and rain, wild animals, snakes and mosquitoes. This monastery will draw bhikkhus from all four directions, now and in the future. You have supported the Dharma with all your heart. I hope you will continue to devote yourself to practicing the way." The next morning, the Buddha and the bhikkhus went into the city to beg. Sariputta divided the bhikkhus into 12 groups, each numbering 15. The presence of the saffron-robed monks further aroused the people's interest in the new Jetavana monastery. The people admired the calm and quiet manner of the bhikkhus. Once a week, the Buddha gave a Dharma talk at Jetavana. Great numbers of people attended. Thus, it was not long before King Basanadi was well aware of the impact of the Buddha's presence. He was too busy with political affairs to visit the Buddha himself, but he listened to many members of his court speak about the new monastery and the bhikkhus from Magadha. During a family meal, the king brought up the subject of the Buddha. Queen Malika informed him of Prince Jetta's contributions to the monastery. The king asked the prince to tell him about the Buddha, and the prince recounted all he had seen and heard. The prince said that if the king granted permission, he wished to become a lay disciple of the Buddha. King Basanadi had a hard time believing that a monk as young as the Buddha could have achieved true enlightenment. According to the prince, the Buddha was 39 years old, the same age as the king. The king speculated that there was no way the Buddha could have attained a higher state than such elderly spiritual teachers as Purunakasapa, Makkali Gosala, Niganta Nataputta, and Sanjaya Belatiputta. Although the king would have liked to believe his son, he had his doubts. He decided that when an occasion arose, he would go and meet the Buddha himself. The rainy season was approaching, and the Buddha decided to spend it at Jetavana. Thanks to the experience gained during previous rainy seasons at Bamboo Forest, the Buddha's senior disciples organized the retreat with ease. 60 new bhikkhus joined the community in Savatthi. Suddhata also introduced many friends who became lay disciples and enthusiastically supported the activities of the monastery. One afternoon, the Buddha received a young man whose face was lined with grief and misery. The Buddha learned that the man had recently lost his only son, and for several days had stood in the cemetery crying out loud, my son, where have you gone?" The man was unable to eat, drink, or sleep. The Buddha told him, "In love there is suffering." The man objected, "You are wrong. Love doesn't cause suffering. Love brings only happiness and joy." The bereaved man abruptly left before the Buddha could explain what he had meant. The man wandered aimlessly about until he stopped to chat with a group of men gambling in the street. He told them of his encounter with the Buddha. The men agreed with him that the Buddha was mistaken. "How can love cause suffering? Love brings only happiness and joy. You're right. That monk Gautama was wrong." Before long, news of this story spread throughout Savatthi and became a subject for heated debate. Many spiritual leaders contended that the Buddha was wrong about love. This matter reached the ears of King Pasenadi, and that evening, during the family meal, he said to the queen, "The monk the people call Buddha may not be as great a teacher as the people seem to think he is." The queen asked, "What makes you say that? Has someone said something bad about teacher Gautama?" "This morning I heard some palace officials discussing Gautama. They said that according to him, the more you love, the more you suffer." The queen said, "If Gautama said that, it is undoubtedly true." The king retorted impatiently, "You shouldn't speak like that. Examine things for yourself. Don't be like some small child who believes everything the teacher says." The queen said no more. She knew that the king had not yet met the Buddha. The next morning, she asked a close friend, the Brahmin Nalijanga, to visit the Buddha and ask him whether or not he had said that love was the source of suffering, and if he had, to explain why. She asked her friend to note carefully everything the Buddha said and report back to her. Nalijanga went to see the Buddha and asked him the queen's question. The Buddha responded, "Recently I heard that a woman in Savatthi lost her mother. She was so grief-stricken that she lost her mind and has been wandering the streets asking everyone, 'Have you seen my mother? Have you seen my mother?' I also heard about two young lovers who committed suicide together because the girl's parents were forcing her to marry someone else. These two stories alone demonstrate that love can cause suffering." Nalijanga repeated the Buddha's words to Queen Malika. One day, soon after that, she caught the king in a moment of leisure, and she asked him, "My husband, do you not love and cherish Princess Vajiri?"
"Indeed I do," answered the king, surprised by the question.
"If some misfortune befell her, would you suffer?" The king was startled. Suddenly, he saw clearly that the seeds of suffering existed within love. His sense of well-being was replaced with worry. The Buddha's words contained a cruel truth, which greatly disturbed the king. He said, "I will go visit this monk Gautama as soon as I have a chance." The queen was happy, for she was confident that once the king met the Buddha, he would understand how extraordinary the Buddha's teaching was. Chapter 42. Love is Understanding. King Pasenadi came all alone to visit the Buddha, unaccompanied by even a guard. He left his carriage and driver at the monastery gate. He was greeted by the Buddha in front of the Buddha's thatched hut. After exchanging formal greetings, the king spoke to the Buddha most frankly. "Teacher Gautama, people praise you as the Buddha, one who has attained perfect enlightenment. But I have been asking myself, how could one as young as yourself have attained enlightenment? Even the great masters such as Purana Kassapa, Makali Gosala, Nigantha Nataputta, and Sanjaya Belatiputta, who are all advanced in years, do not claim to have attained total enlightenment. Not even Pakuda Kakayana and Ajita Kesakambali. Do you know of these masters?" The Buddha responded, "Your Majesty, I have heard of all those masters and have met a number of them. Spiritual realization does not depend on age.
Months and years do not guarantee the presence of enlightenment. There are some things that should never be disdained. A young prince, a small snake, a spark of fire, and a young monk. A prince may be young, but he possesses the characteristics and destiny of a king. A small poisonous snake can kill a grown man in an instant. One spark of fire can cause an entire forest or a large city to burn to ash. And a young monk can attain total Your Majesty, a wise person never disdains a young prince, a small snake, a spark of fire, or a young monk. King Pasenadi looked at the Buddha. He was impressed. The Buddha had spoken in a calm and quiet voice, and what he had said was at once simple and profound. The king felt he could trust the Buddha. He then asked the question that was burning within him. Teacher Gautama, there are people who say you advise people not to love. They say you have said that the more a person loves, the more he will suffer and despair. I can see some truth in that statement, but I am unable to find peace with it. Without love, life would seem empty of meaning. Please help me resolve this. The Buddha looked at the king warmly. Your Majesty, your question is a very good one, and many people can benefit from it. There are many kinds of love. We should examine closely the nature of each kind of love. Life has a great need of the presence of love, but not the sort of love that is based on lust, passion, attachment, discrimination, and prejudice. Majesty, there is another kind of love, sorely needed, which consists of loving kindness and compassion, or Maitri and Karuna. Usually when people speak of love, they are referring only to the love that exists between parents and children, husbands and wives, family members, or the members of one's caste or country. Because the nature of such love depends on the concepts of me and mine, it remains entangled in attachment and discrimination. People want only to love their parents, spouse, children, grandchildren, their own relatives and countrymen. Because they are caught in attachment, they worry about accidents that could befall their loved ones even before such things actually take place. When such accidents do occur, they suffer terribly. Love that is based on discrimination breeds prejudice. People become indifferent or even hostile to those outside their own circle of love. Attachment and discrimination are sources of suffering for ourselves and others. Majesty, the love for which all beings truly hunger is loving kindness and compassion. Maitri is the love that has the capacity to bring happiness to another. Karuna is the love that has the capacity to remove another's suffering. Maitri and Karuna do not demand anything in return. Loving kindness and compassion are not limited to one's parents, spouse, children, relatives, caste members, and countrymen. They extend to all people and all beings. In Maitri and Karuna, there is no discrimination, no mine or not mine. And because there is no discrimination, there is no attachment. Maitri and Karuna bring happiness and ease suffering. They do not cause suffering and despair. Without them, life would be empty of meaning, as you said. With loving kindness and compassion, life is filled with peace, joy, and contentment. Majesty, you are the ruler of an entire country. All your people would benefit by your practice of loving kindness and compassion. The king bent his head in thought. He looked up and asked the Buddha, I have a family to care for and a country to rule. If I don't love my own family and people, how can I care for them? Please help clarify this for me. Naturally, you should love your own family and people. But your love can also extend beyond your own family and people. You love and care for the prince and princess, but that doesn't prevent you from loving and caring for the other young people in the kingdom. If you can love all the young people, your now limited love will become an all-embracing love, and all the young people of the kingdom will be as your children. That is what is meant by having a heart of compassion. It is not just some ideal. It is something that can actually be realized, especially by someone like you who has so many means at his disposal. But what about the young people of other kingdoms? Nothing prevents you from loving the young people of other kingdoms as your sons and daughters, even though they do not dwell under your rule. Just because one loves one's own people is no reason not to love the peoples of other kingdoms. But how can I show my love for them when they are not under my jurisdiction? The Buddha looked at the king. The prosperity and security of one nation should not depend on the poverty and insecurity of other nations. Majesty, lasting peace and prosperity are only possible when nations join together in a common commitment to seek the welfare of all. If you truly want Kosala to enjoy peace, and to prevent the young men of your kingdom from losing their lives on the battlefield, you must help other kingdoms find peace. Foreign and economic policies must follow the way of compassion for true peace to be possible. At the same time as you love and care for your own kingdom, you can love and care for other kingdoms such as Mugada, Kasi, Videha, Sakya, and Koliya. Majesty, last year I visited my family in the kingdom of Sakya. I rested several days in Aranakutika at the foot of the Himalayas. There I spent much time reflecting on a politics based on nonviolence. I saw that nations can indeed enjoy peace and security without having to resort to violent measures such as imprisonment and execution. I spoke of these things with my father, King Suddhodana. Now I take this opportunity to share these same ideas with you. A ruler who nourishes his compassion does not need to depend on violent means. The king exclaimed, "Wondrous, truly wondrous! Your words are inspiring. You truly are the Enlightened One. I promise to reflect on all you have said today. I will penetrate your words, which contain so much wisdom. But for now, please, allow me to ask one more simple question. Ordinarily, love does contain elements of discrimination, desire, and attachment. According to you, that kind of love creates worry, suffering, and despair. How can one love without desire and attachment? How can I avoid creating worry and suffering in the love I hold for my own children?" The Buddha replied, "We need to look at the nature of our love. Our love should bring peace and happiness to the ones we love. If our love is based on a selfish desire to possess others, we will not be able to bring them peace and happiness. On the contrary, our love will make them feel trapped. Such a love is no more than a prison. If the persons we love are unable to be happy because of our love, they will find a way to free themselves. They will not accept the prison of our love. Gradually, the love between us will turn to anger and hatred. Majesty, did you hear of the tragedy that took place 10 days ago in Savati because of selfish love? A mother felt she had been abandoned by her son when he fell in love and married. Rather than feeling as if she had gained a daughter, she only felt that she had lost her son, and she felt betrayed by him. Because of that, her love turned to hatred, and she put poison in the young couple's food, killing them both. Majesty, according to the way of enlightenment, love cannot exist without understanding. Love is understanding. If you cannot understand, you cannot love. Husbands and wives who do not understand each other cannot love each other. Brothers and sisters who do not understand each other cannot love each other. Parents and children who do not understand each other cannot love each other. If you want your loved ones to be happy, you must learn to understand their sufferings and their aspirations. When you understand, you will know how to relieve their sufferings and how to help them fulfill their aspirations. That is true love. If you only want your loved ones to follow your own ideas and you remain ignorant of their needs, it is not truly love. It is only a desire to possess another and attempt to fulfill your own needs, which cannot be fulfilled in that way. Majesty, the people of Kosala have sufferings and aspirations. If you can understand their sufferings and aspirations, you will be able to truly love them. All the officials in your court have sufferings and aspirations. Understand those sufferings and aspirations, and you will know how to bring them happiness. Thanks to that, they will remain loyal to you all their lives. The queen, prince, and princess have their own sufferings and aspirations. If you can understand those sufferings and aspirations, you'll be able to bring them happiness. When every person enjoys happiness, peace, and joy, you yourself will know happiness, peace, and joy. That is the meaning of love according to the way of awakening." King Pasenadi was deeply moved. No other spiritual teacher or Brahmana priest had ever opened the door to his heart and allowed him to understand things so deeply. The presence of this teacher, he thought to himself, was of great value to his country. He wanted to be the Buddha's student. After a moment of silence, he looked up at the Buddha and said, "I thank you for shedding so much light on these matters for me. But there remains one thing that still bothers me. You said that love based on desire and attachment creates suffering and despair, while love based on compassion brings only peace and happiness. But while I see that love based on the way of compassion is not selfish or self-serving, it still can bring pain and suffering. I love my people. When they suffer from some natural disaster like a typhoon or flood, I suffer too. I'm sure it is the same for you. Surely you suffer when you see someone who is sick or dying. Your question is very good. Thanks to this question, you will be able to understand more deeply the nature of compassion. First of all, you should know that the suffering caused by love based on desire and attachment is 1,000 times greater than the suffering that results from compassion. It is necessary to distinguish between the two kinds of suffering. One that is entirely useless and serves only to disturb our minds and bodies, and the other that nourishes caring and responsibility. Love based on compassion can provide the energy to respond to the suffering of others. Love based on attachment and desire only creates anxiety and more suffering. Compassion provides fuel for the most helpful actions and service. Great King, compassion is most necessary. Pain that results from compassion can be a helpful pain. If you cannot feel another person's pain, you are not truly human. Compassion is the fruit of understanding. Practicing the way of awareness is to realize the true face of life. That true face is impermanence. Everything is impermanent and without a separate self. Everything must one day pass away. One day your own body will pass away. When a person sees into the impermanent nature of all things, his way of looking becomes calm and serene. The presence of impermanence does not disturb his heart and mind, and thus the feelings of pain that result from compassion do not carry the bitter and heavy nature that other kinds of suffering do. On the contrary, compassion gives a person greater strength. Great King, today you have heard some of the basic tenets of the way of liberation. On another day, I would like to share more of the teachings with you. King Pasenadi's heart was filled with gratitude. He stood up and bowed to the Buddha. He knew that one day soon he would ask to be accepted as a lay disciple of the Buddha. He knew that Queen Malika, Prince Jetta, and Princess Vajiri already felt a special bond with the Buddha. He wanted the entire family to receive the refuges together. He knew that his younger sister, Kosala Devi, and her husband, King Bimbisara, had already received them. That evening, Queen Malika and Princess Vajiri noticed a marked difference in the king. He seemed unusually calm and content. They knew it was the result of his encounter with the Buddha. They wanted very much to ask the king about his meeting with the Buddha, but they knew that they should wait and let the king tell them about it in his own time. Chapter 43. Everyone's Tears Are Salty. King Pasenadi's visit to Jetavana stirred interest among the people and added to the stature of the Buddha Sangha. Palace officials noticed how King Pasenadi did not miss a single weekly Dharma talk, and many of them began to join him. Some did so out of admiration for the Buddha's teaching, while others went only in hopes of pleasing the king. The number of intellectuals and young people visiting Jetavana also mounted daily. During the 3 months of retreat, more than 150 young men were ordained by Sariputta. Religious leaders of other sects that had long enjoyed the king's patronage began to feel threatened, and some of them began to regard Jetavana Monastery with less than sympathetic eyes. The retreat season concluded with a large service at which the king offered new robes to every bhikkhu and distributed food and other basic necessities to poor families. At this ceremony, the king and his family formally took the 3 refuges. After the retreat, the Buddha and other bhikkhus traveled to neighboring regions in order to spread the Dharma to more and more people. One day, as the Buddha and bhikkhus were begging in a village near the banks of the Ganga, the Buddha spotted a man carrying night soil. The man was an untouchable named Sunita. Sunita had heard about the Buddha and bhikkhus, but this was the first time he had ever seen them. He was alarmed, knowing how dirty his clothes were and how foul he smelled from carrying night soil. He quickly moved off the path and made his way down to the river. But the Buddha was determined to share the way with Sunita. When Sunita veered from the path, the Buddha did the same. Understanding the Buddha's intent, Sariputta and Meghiya, the Buddha's attendant at the time, followed him. The rows of other bhikkhus came to a halt, and they quietly watched. Sunita was panic-stricken. He hastily put the buckets of night soil down and looked for a place to hide. Above him stood the bhikkhus in their saffron robes, while before him approached the Buddha and two other bhikkhus. Not knowing what else to do, Sunita waded up to his knees in water and stood with his palms joined. Curious villagers came out of their homes and lined the shore to watch what was happening. Sunita had veered off the path because he was afraid he would pollute the bhikkhus. He could not have guessed the Buddha would follow him. Sunita knew that the Sangha included many men from noble castes. He was sure that polluting a bhikkhu was an unforgivable act. He hoped the Buddha and bhikkhus would leave him and return to the road. But the Buddha did not leave. He walked right up to the water's edge and said, "My friend, please come closer so we may talk." Sunita, his palms still joined, protested, "Lord, I don't dare." "Why not?" asked the Buddha. "I am an untouchable. I don't want to pollute you and your monks." The Buddha replied, "On our path, we no longer distinguish between castes. You are a human being like the rest of us. We are not afraid we will be polluted. Only greed, hatred, and delusion can pollute us. A person as pleasant as yourself brings us nothing but happiness. What is your name?"
"Lord, my name is Sunita."
"Sunita, would you like to become a bhikkhu like the rest of us?"
"I couldn't."
"Why not?"
"I'm an untouchable."
"Sunita, I've already explained that on our path there is no caste. In the way of awakening, caste no longer exists. It is like the Ganga, Yamuna, Achiravati, Sarabhu, Mahi, and Rohini rivers. Once they empty into the sea, they no longer retain their separate identities. A person who leaves home to follow the way leaves caste behind, whether he was born a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, or untouchable. Sunita, if you like, you can become a bhikkhu like the rest of us." Sunita could hardly believe his ears. He placed his joined palms before his forehead and said, "No one has ever spoken so kindly to me before. This is the happiest day of my life. If you accept me as your disciple, I vow to devote all my being to practicing your teaching." The Buddha handed his bowl to Meghiya and reached his hand out to Sunita. He said, "Sariputta, help me bathe Sunita. We will ordain him a bhikkhu right here on the bank of the river." Venerable Sariputta smiled. He placed his own bowl on the ground and came forward to assist the Buddha. Sunita felt awkward and uncomfortable as Sariputta and the Buddha scrubbed him clean, but he didn't dare protest. The Buddha asked Meghiya to go up and ask Ananda for an extra robe. After Sunita was ordained, the Buddha assigned him to Sariputta's care. Sariputta led him back to Jetavana, while the Buddha and the rest of the bhikkhus calmly continued their begging. The local people had witnessed all this take place. News quickly spread that the Buddha had accepted an untouchable into his sangha. This caused a furor among higher castes in the capital. Never in the history of Kosala had an untouchable been accepted into a spiritual community. Many condemned the Buddha for violating sacred tradition. Others went so far as to suggest that the Buddha was plotting to overthrow the existing order and wreak havoc in the country. The echoes of all these accusations reached the monastery through lay disciples as well as from bhikkhus who heard people saying such things in the city. Senior disciples Sariputta, Mahakasapa, Mahamoggallana, and Anuruddha met to discuss the people's reactions with the Buddha. The Buddha said, "Accepting untouchables into the Sangha was simply a question of time. Our way is a way of equality. We do not recognize caste. Though we may encounter difficulties over Sunita's ordination now, we will have opened a door for the first time in history that future generations will thank us for. We must have courage." Moggallana said, "We do not lack courage or endurance, but how can we help reduce the hostility of public opinion to make it easier for the bhikkhus to practice?" Sariputta said, "The important thing is to remain trusting of our practice. I will strive to assist Sunita in making progress on the path. His success will be the strongest argument in our favor. We can also seek ways to explain our belief in equality to the people. What do you think, Master?" The Buddha placed his hand on Sariputta's shoulder. "You have just spoken my own thoughts," he said. Before long, The uproar over Sunita's ordination reached the ears of King Pasenadi. A group of religious leaders requested a private audience with him and expressed their grave concerns over the matter. Their convincing arguments disturbed the king, and although he was a devoted follower of the Buddha, he promised the leaders that he would look into the matter. Some days later, he paid a visit to Jetavana. He climbed down from his carriage and walked into the monastery grounds alone. Bhikkhus passed him on the path beneath the cool shade of trees. The king followed the path that led to the Buddha's hut. He bowed to each bhikkhu he passed. As always, the serene and composed manner of the bhikkhus reinforced his faith in the Buddha. Halfway to the hut, he encountered a bhikkhu sitting on a large rock beneath a great pine tree teaching a small group of bhikkhus and lay disciples. It was a most appealing sight. The bhikkhu offering the teaching looked less than 40 years old, yet his face radiated great peace and wisdom. His listeners were clearly absorbed by what he had to say. The king paused to listen and was moved by what he heard. But suddenly he remembered the purpose of his visit, and he continued on his way. He hoped to return later to listen to the bhikkhu's teaching. The Buddha welcomed the king outside his hut, inviting him to sit on a bamboo chair. After they exchanged formal greetings, the king asked the Buddha who the bhikkhu sitting on the rock was. The Buddha smiled and answered, "That is Bhikkhu Sunita. He was once an untouchable who carried night soil. What do you think of his teaching?" The king felt embarrassed. The bhikkhu with so radiant a bearing was none other than the night soil carrier. He would never have guessed this was possible. Before he knew how to respond, the Buddha said, "Bhikkhu Sunita has devoted himself wholeheartedly to his practice from the day of his ordination. He is a man of great sincerity, intelligence, and resolve. Though he was ordained only 3 months ago, he has already earned a reputation for great virtue and purity of heart. Would you like to meet him and make an offering to this most worthy bhikkhu?" The king replied with frankness, "I would indeed like to meet Bhikkhu Sunita and make an offering to him. Master, your teaching is deep and wondrous. I have never met any other spiritual teacher with so open a heart and mind. I do not think there is a person, animal, or plant that does not benefit from the presence of your understanding. I must tell you that I came here today with the intention of asking how you could accept an untouchable into your sangha. But I have seen, heard, and understood why. I no longer dare ask such a question. Instead, allow me to prostrate myself before you." The king stood up, intending to prostrate himself, but the Buddha stood up as well and took the king's hand. He asked the king to be seated again. When they were both seated, the Buddha looked at the king and said, "Majesty, in the way of liberation, there is no caste. To the eyes of an enlightened person, all people are equal. Every person's blood is red. Every person's tears are salty. We are all human beings. We must find a way for all people to be able to realize their full dignity and potential. That is why I welcome Sunita into the Sangha of Bhikkhus." The king joined his palms. "I understand now. I also know that the path you have chosen will be filled with obstacles and difficulties. But I know you possess the strength and courage needed to overcome all such obstacles. For my own part, I will do everything in my power to support the true teaching." The king took his leave of the Buddha and returned to the pine tree in hopes of listening to Bhikkhu Sunita's teaching. But Bhikkhu Sunita and his listeners had disappeared. The king saw no more than a few bhikkhus walking slowly and mindfully down the path. Chapter 44. The Elements Will Recombine. One day, Meghia spoke to the Buddha about Nanda's unhappiness as a monk. Nanda had confided to Meghia how much he missed his fiancée in Kapilavatu. Nanda said, "I still remember the day I carried the Buddha's bowl back to Nigrodha Park. As I was leaving, Janapada Kalyani looked into my eyes and said, 'Hurry back, I will be waiting for you.' I can so clearly recall the sheen of her black hair as it brushes her slender shoulders. Her image often arises during my sitting meditation. Every time I see her in my mind, I am filled with longing. I am not happy being a monk." The next afternoon, the Buddha invited Nanda to go for a walk with him. They left Jetavana and headed toward a distant hamlet located by a lake. They sat on a large boulder that overlooked the crystal-clear water. A family of ducks swam by leisurely. Birds sang in the overhanging branches of trees. The Buddha said, "Some of our brothers have told me that you are not happy living the life of a bhikkhu. Is that true?" Nanda was silent. After a moment, the Buddha asked, "Do you feel ready to return to Kapilavatthu to prepare to take over the throne?" Nanda replied hastily, "No, no. I have already told everyone that I do not like politics. I know I don't have the ability to rule a kingdom. I do not wish to become the next king." "Then why are you unhappy being a bhikkhu?" Again, Nanda was silent. "Do you miss Kalyani?" Nanda blushed, but he did not speak. The Buddha said, "Nanda, there are many young women here in Kosala as beautiful as your Kalyani. Do you remember the reception we attended at King Pasenadi's palace? Did you notice any women there as pretty as Kalyani?" Nanda admitted, "Perhaps there are young women here as pretty as she is, but I care only for Kalyani. In this life, there is only one Kalyani." "Nanda, attachment can be a great barrier to spiritual practice. The physical beauty of a woman fades as surely as the beauty of a rose. You know that all things are impermanent. You must learn to penetrate the impermanent nature of things. Look." The Buddha pointed to an old woman leaning on a cane and hobbling across the bamboo bridge. Her face was covered with wrinkles. "That old woman was surely once a beauty. Kalyani's beauty will also fade with the years. During that same time, your search for enlightenment could bring peace and joy for this life and lives to come. Nanda, look at the two monkeys playing over on that branch. You might not find the female attractive with her long pointed snout and red bottom, but to the male she is the most beautiful monkey on earth. To him she is unique, and he would sacrifice his very life to protect her. Can you see that?" Nanda interrupted the Buddha. "Please don't say anything more. I understand what you're trying to say. I will devote myself more wholeheartedly to my practice." The Buddha smiled at his younger brother. "Pay special attention to observing your breath. Meditate on your body, feelings, mental formations, consciousness, and objects of your consciousness. Look deeply in order to see the process of birth, growth, and fading of every phenomenon, from your own body, emotions, mind, and objects of your mind. If there is anything you don't understand, come and ask me or Sariputta. Nanda, remember that the happiness liberation brings is true, unconditional happiness. It can never be destroyed. Aspire to that happiness." The sky was growing dark. The Buddha and Nanda stood and walked back to the monastery. Jetavana now hosted a strong and stable monastic life. The number of bhikkhus living there had risen to 500. The following year, the Buddha returned to Vesali for the retreat season. The Lekavi princes had transformed Great Forest into a monastery. They had built a two-story dharma hall with a roof, which they named Kutagara. A number of smaller buildings were scattered throughout the forest of sal trees. The princes were the sponsors of the retreat season with generous contributions from Ambapali. Bhikkhus throughout Magadha and as far away as Sakya gathered to spend the retreat season there with the Buddha. They numbered 600 in all. Lay disciples traveled to spend the rainy season there as well in order to receive the Buddha's teaching. They brought daily food offerings and attended all the Dharma talks. One morning in early autumn, just after the retreat came to a close, the Buddha received news that King Suddhodana was on his deathbed in Kapilavatthu. The king had sent Prince Mahanama, his nephew, as a messenger to summon the Buddha in hopes of seeing his son one last time. At Mahanama's special request, the Buddha agreed to travel in the carriage in order to save time. Anuruddha, Nanda, Ananda, and Rahula accompanied him. They left so quickly that even the Lekavi princes and Ambapali were unable to see them off. After the carriage departed, 200 bhikkhus, including all the former princes of the Sakya clan, began to walk toward Kapilavatthu. They wanted to be with the Buddha at his father's funeral. The royal family met the Buddha at the palace gates. Mahaprajapati led him at once into the king's chambers. The king's face, pale and wan, brightened when he saw the Buddha. The Buddha sat down by the bed and took the king's hand in his own. The king, now 82 years old, was thin and frail. The Buddha said, "Father, please breathe gently and slowly. Smile. Nothing is more important than your breath at this moment. Nanda, Ananda, Rahula, Anuruddha, and I will breathe together with you." The king looked at each one of them. He smiled and began to follow his breath. No one dared cry. After a moment, the king looked at the Buddha and said, "I have seen clearly the impermanence of life, and how if a person wants happiness, he should not lose himself in a life of desires. Happiness is obtained by living a life of simplicity and freedom." Queen Gotami told the Buddha, "These past months the king has lived very simply. He has followed your teaching. Your teaching has transformed the lives of every one of us here." Still holding the king's hand, the Buddha said, "Father, take a deep look at me, at Nanda and Rahula. Look at the green leaves on the branches outside your window. Life continues. As life continues, so do you. You will continue to live in me, and in Nanda and Rahula, and in all beings. The temporal body arises from the four elements, which dissolve only to endlessly recombine again. Father, don't think that because the body passes away, life and death can bind us. Rahula's body is also your body." The Buddha motioned to Rahula to come and hold the king's other hand. A lovely smile arose on the face of the dying king. He understood the Buddha's words, and he no longer feared death. The king's advisors and ministers were all present. He motioned for them to approach, and in a feeble voice said, "During my reign, I have doubtlessly upset and wronged you. Before I die, I ask your forgiveness." The advisors and ministers could not hold back their tears. Prince Mahanama knelt by the bed and said, "Your Majesty, you have been the most virtuous and just of kings. No one here has any reason to fault you." Mahanama continued, "I humbly wish to suggest that Prince Nanda now leave monastic life and return to Kapilavatu to ascend the throne. The people would all be happy to see your own son as king. I pledge to assist and support him with all my being." Nanda looked at the Buddha as if to plead for rescue. Queen Gotami also looked at the Buddha's way. Quietly, the Buddha spoke, "Father, ministers, please allow me to share my insight in this matter. Nanda does not yet possess the inclination or ability to serve as a political ruler. He needs more years of spiritual practice to be ready for such a task. Rahula is only 15 years old and too young to become king. I believe Prince Mahanama is the best qualified to be king. He is a man of great intelligence and talent, as well as a man of compassion and understanding. Furthermore, he has served as the king's chief advisor these past 6 years. On behalf of the royal family, on behalf of the people, I ask Prince Mahanama to accept this difficult responsibility." Mahanama joined his palms and protested, "I fear my talent falls far short of what is required of a king. Please, Your Majesty, Lord Buddha, and ministers, choose someone more worthy than I am." The other ministers voiced their approval of the Buddha's suggestion. The king nodded his approval as well and called Mahanama to his side. He took Mahanama's hand and said, "Everyone places his trust in you. The Buddha himself has faith in you. You are my nephew, and I would be honored and happy to pass the throne unto you. You will continue our line for 100 generations. Mahanama bowed, submitting to the king's wishes. The king was overjoyed. "Now I can close my eyes in peace. I am happy to have seen the Buddha before I left this world. My heart is now without any cares whatsoever. I have no regrets or bitterness. I hope that the Buddha will rest in Kapilavatu for a time in order to assist Mahanama in the first days of his reign. Your virtue, Lord Buddha, will assure our country 100 generations of peace." The king's voice faded to barely a whisper. The Buddha said, "I will remain here for whatever time is needed to help Mahanama." The king smiled weakly, but his eyes radiated peace. He closed his eyes and passed from this life. Queen Gotami and Yosadhara began to cry. The ministers sobbed in grief. The Buddha folded the king's hands on his chest and then motioned for everyone to stop crying. He told them to follow their breathing. After several moments, he suggested they meet in the outer chamber to discuss arrangements for the funeral. The funeral took place 7 days later. More than 1,000 Brahmins attended the ceremony. But King Suddhodana's funeral was made unique by the presence of 500 saffron-robed bhikkhus who represented the way of the Buddha. In addition to the traditional Brahmana prayers and recitations, sutras of the way were chanted. The bhikkhus chanted the Four Noble Truths, the Sutra on Impermanence, the Sutra on Fire, the Sutra on Dependent Co-arising, and the Three Refuges. They chanted in the tongue of Magadhi, which was spoken by all the peoples east of the Ganga. The Buddha slowly circled the funeral pyre 3 times. Before he lit the funeral pyre, he said, "Birth, old age, sickness, and death occur in the life of all persons. We should reflect on birth, old age, sickness, and death every day in order to prevent ourselves from becoming lost in desires and in order to be able to create a life filled with peace, joy, and contentment. A person who has attained the way looks on birth, old age, sickness, and death with equanimity. The true nature of all dharmas is that there is neither birth nor death, neither production nor destruction, neither increasing nor decreasing." Once lit, flames consumed the pyre. The sounds of gongs and drums intertwined with chanting. The people of Kapilavatu attended in great numbers to see the Buddha light the king's funeral pyre. After Mahanama's coronation, the Buddha remained in Kapilavatu for 3 months. One day, Mahapajapati Gotami visited him at Nigrodha Park. She offered a number of robes and also requested to be ordained as a nun. She said, "If you will allow women to be ordained, many will benefit. Among our clan, many princes have left home to become your disciples. Many of them had wives. Now their wives desire to study the Dharma as nuns. I want to be ordained myself. It would bring me great joy. This has been my sole desire since the king died." The Buddha was silent for a long moment before he said, "It is not possible." Lady Pajapati pleaded, "I know this is a difficult issue for you. If you accept women into the Sangha, you will be met with protest and resistance from society. But I do not believe you are afraid of such reactions." Again, the Buddha was silent. He said, "In Rajagaha, there are also a number of women who want to be ordained, but I don't believe it is the right time yet. Conditions are not yet ripe to accept women in the Sangha." Gotami pleaded 3 times with him, but his answer remained the same. Deeply disappointed, she departed. When she returned to the palace, she told Yasodhara of the Buddha's response. A few days later, the Buddha returned to Vesali. After his departure, Gotami gathered all the women who wished to be ordained. They included a number of young women who had never been married. All the women belonged to the Sakya clan. She told them, "I know beyond a doubt that in the way of awakening, all people are equal. Everyone has the capacity to be enlightened and liberated. The Buddha has said so himself. He has accepted untouchables into the Sangha. There is no reason he should not accept women. We are full persons too. We can attain enlightenment and liberation. There is no reason to regard women as inferior. I suggest we shave our heads, get rid of our fine clothes and jewels, put on the yellow robes of bhikkhus, and walk barefoot to Vesali, where we will ask to be ordained. In this way, we will prove to the Buddha and everyone else that we are capable of living simply and practicing the way. We will walk hundreds of miles and beg for our food. This is the only hope we have to be accepted into the Sangha." All the women agreed with Gotami. They saw in her a true leader. Yasodhara smiled. She had long appreciated Gotami's strong will. Gotami was not one to be stopped by any obstacle, as proved by her years of working on behalf of the poor with Yasodhara. The women agreed on a day to put their plan into action. Gotami said to Yasodhara, "Gopa, it would be best if you didn't come with us this time. When we have succeeded, there will be plenty of time for you to follow." Yasodhara smiled in understanding. "Follow, or with us this time. Things may go more smoothly. When we have succeeded, there will be plenty of time for you to follow." Yasodhara smiled in understanding. Chapter 45. Opening the Door. Early one morning, on his way to the lake to get some water, Ananda met Gotami and 50 other women standing not far from the Buddha's hut. Every woman had shaved her head and was wearing a yellow robe. Their feet were swollen and bloody. At first glance, Ananda thought it was a delegation of monks, but suddenly he recognized Lady Gotami. Hardly able to believe his eyes, he blurted, "Good heavens, Lady Gotami, where have you come from? Why are your feet so bloody? Why have you and all the ladies come here like this?" Gotami answered, "Venerable Ananda, we have shaved our heads and given away all our fine clothes and jewels. We no longer have any possessions in this world. We left Kapilavatu and have walked for 15 days, sleeping by the roadsides and begging for our food in small villages along the way. We wish to show that we are capable of living like bhikkhus. I beseech you, Ananda, please speak to the Buddha on our behalf. We wish to be ordained as nuns." Ananda said, "Wait here. I will speak to the Buddha at once. I promise to do all I can." Ananda entered the Buddha's hut just as the Buddha was putting on his robe. Nagita, the Buddha's assistant at that time, was also present. Ananda told the Buddha all he had just seen and heard. The Buddha did not say anything. Ananda then asked, "Lord, is it possible for a woman to attain the fruits of stream enterer, once returner, never returner, and arhatship?" The Buddha answered, "Beyond a doubt." "Then why won't you accept women into the Sangha? Lady Gotama nurtured and cared for you from the time you were an infant. She has loved you like a son. Now she has shaved her head and renounced all her possessions. She has walked all the way from Kapilavatu to prove that women can endure anything that men can. Please have compassion and allow her to be ordained." The Buddha was silent for a long moment. He then asked Nagita to summon Venerable Sariputta, Moggallana, Anuruddha, Badiya, Kimbila, and Mahakasapa. When they arrived, he discussed the situation with them at length. He explained that it was not discrimination against women that made him hesitant to ordain them. He was unsure how to open the Sangha to women without creating harmful conflict both within and outside of the Sangha. After a lengthy exchange of ideas, Sariputta said, "It would be wise to create statutes that define the roles of nuns within the Sangha. Such statutes would diminish public opposition, which is certain to erupt, since there has been discrimination against women for thousands of years. Please consider the following 8 rules. First, a nun, or bhikkhuni, will always defer to a bhikkhu, even if she is older or has practiced longer than he has. Second, all bhikkhunis must spend the retreat season at a center within reach of a center of bhikkhus in order to receive spiritual support and further study. Third, twice a month, the bhikkhunis should delegate someone to invite the bhikkhus to decide on a date for uposatha, the special day of observance. A bhikkhu should visit the nuns, teach them, and encourage them in their practice. Fourth, after the rainy season retreat, nuns must attend the pavarana ceremony and present an account of their practice, not only before other nuns, but before the monks. Fifth, whenever a bhikkhuni breaks a precept, she must confess before both the bhikkhunis and the bhikkhus. Sixth, after a period of practice as a novice, a bhikkhuni will take full vows before the communities of both monks and nuns. Seventh, a bhikkhuni should not criticize or censure a bhikkhu. Eighth, a bhikkhuni will not give dharma instruction to a community of bhikkhus." Moggallana laughed. "These 8 rules are clearly discriminatory. How can you pretend otherwise?" Sariputta replied, "The purpose of these rules is to open the door for women to join the Sangha. They are not intended to discriminate, but to help end discrimination. Don't you see?" Moggallana nodded, acknowledging the merit of Sariputta's statement. Badiya said, "These 8 rules are necessary. Lady Gotami has commanded much authority. She is the Lord's mother. Without rules such as these, it would be difficult for anyone to accept the Buddha himself to guide her in her practice." The Buddha turned to Ananda. "Ananda, please go and tell Lady Mahapashapati that if she is willing to accept these 8 special rules, she and the other women may be ordained." The sun had already climbed high into the sky, but Ananda found Lady Gotami and the other women patiently waiting. After hearing the 8 rules, Gotami was overjoyed. She replied, "Venerable Ananda, please tell the Buddha that just as a young girl gladly accepts a garland of lotus flowers or roses to adorn her hair after washing it with perfumed water, I happily accept the 8 rules. I will follow them all my life if I am granted permission to be ordained." Ananda returned to the Buddha's hut and informed him of Lady Gotami's response. The other women looked at Gotami with concern in their eyes, but she smiled and reassured them. Don't worry, my sisters. The important thing is that we have earned the right to be ordained. These 8 rules will not be barriers to our practice. They are the door by which we may enter the Sangha. All 51 women were ordained that same day. Venerable Sariputta arranged for them to live temporarily at Ambapali's mango grove. The Buddha also asked Sariputta to teach the nuns the basic practice. 8 days later, Bhikkhuni Mahapajapati paid a visit to the Buddha. She said, Lord, please show compassion and explain how I may best make quick progress on the path of liberation. The Buddha answered, Bhikkhuni Mahapajapati, the most important thing is to take hold of your own mind. Practice observing the breath and meditate on the body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind. Practicing like that, each day you will experience a deepening of humility, ease, detachment, peace, and joy. When those qualities arise, you can be sure you are on the correct path, the path of awakening and enlightenment. Bhikkhuni Mahapajapati wanted to build a convent in Visali in order to enable the nuns to dwell close to the Buddha and his senior disciples. She also wanted later to return to Kapilavatthu to open a convent in her homeland. She sent a messenger to Yasodhara to announce the good news of the women's ordination. Bhikkhuni Gotami knew that the acceptance of women into the Sangha would create an uproar. Bitter opposition would undoubtedly result, and many people would condemn the Buddha and his Sangha. She knew the Buddha would have to face many difficulties. She was grateful and understood that the 8 rules were temporarily necessary to protect the Sangha from harmful conflict. She was sure that later on, once the ordination of women was an established fact, the 8 rules would no longer be necessary. The Buddha's community now had 4 streams, the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasaka, male lay disciples, and upasika, female lay disciples. Bhikkhuni Mahapajapati gave careful thought as to how the bhikkhunis should dress. Her suggestions were all accepted by the Buddha. The bhikkhus wore 3 garments, the antaravasaka, or pants, the uttarasanga, or inner robe, and the sangati, or outer robe. In addition to these 3 garments, the bhikkhunis added a cloth wrapped around the chest called a samkakshika and a shirt called kusulaka. In addition to their robes and begging bowl, each monk and nun also had the right to own a fan, a water filter, a needle and thread to mend their robes, a pick to clean their teeth, and a razor to shave their heads twice a month.